Hello and welcome to Arts Roundup, which this month discovers some new and interesting things going on in Cambridge's art dimension, ranging from the world of top-notch political cartoonery to a new all-encompassing arts festival, and even a spot of homegrown music in a historic Cambridge setting. In this edition, art conservator Penny Heath takes us through the new gallery space at Kettle's Yard as the team works feverishly to unpack the boxes and crates and make all things right and ready for its grand reopening next week. Political cartoonist Andy Davey talks about a dying and sometimes dangerous art that still has its place in the national psyche. Andrea Cockerton from choir We Are Sound gives us some insight on singing in the city and her plans for a new Cambridge summer arts festival she's founded. And Italian bright spark Alexandra Cagliano previews this year's Illuminate Cambridge Festival and talks about what happens behind the scenes with digital marketing expert Sukio. Kettle's Yard Gallery has had a breathtaking revamp which has taken 2 years to complete and has practically broken the bank, but as I found out, the project, which had its doubters at first, is now an entirely different matter now that it's complete. The gallery building, designed by architect Jamie Fobart, now allows for a variety of artists, teachers and experts to really stretch out impressively. It also features an education wing that takes you by surprise with a wow. As you enter, it drops down some 25 feet below a balcony and walkway and stairs into a large and spacious modern creative space featuring a muck-proof floor for messy creativity, space for up to 50 people, a state-of-the-art smart screen, a disabled lift and other swish facilities. An opening exhibition will feature 38 artists' work, 31 of them living. Just one example to whet your appetite is French-Tunisian artist El Saïd, who's coming to Cambridge to paint on the side of a building in Arbury Court. He specialises in large-scale documentary art projects on the sides of buildings in Cairo. Art conservator Penny Heath took some time out to show me the venue. How important has the Friends of Kettle's Yard been to this whole project? Because they are the Kettle's Yard community, aren't they?
Very much so. I think the Friends have been enormously important. I mean, we've existed for 20 years, this very sort of loyal band of people who love the place for what it is. And we've watched this fairly dramatic transformation, but we've been behind it all the time. And we've actually given quite a lot of financial support, but also the whole morale of keeping... Well, it's a big risk taking down an old gallery and building a new space. And you know, we're really excited and feel...
Penny, tell me a little bit about yourself, because you're going to be, you've been arranging the launch party, but how did you come to be so involved in Kettle's Yard?
Well, I should say one of the launch parties, but now I am partially involved in the reopening for the Friends, particular, their own Friends party in a couple of weeks' time. My own involvement, I feel really privileged to be part of this community. I came back to Cambridge about 20 years ago. My background is in the art world. I'm actually conservator by training, and they were wanting volunteers on the committee of the Friends, and I've just been part of that organisation, and it's the most delightful group of people in the arts and community in Cambridge.
Now, I'm looking at from the outside of the gallery. There are some fantastic children's posters on the outside. The frontage has all been redone, but what are people going to discover once they get inside to the new Kettle's Yard?
Well, I think one of the main things is two things. One is to reassure people that the old Kettle's Yard, the house as they knew it before, is still there, and I think the Friends are particularly protective about that whole, you know, extraordinary spirit and identity of Kettle's Yard. But when you walk in the new door, you are going to be wowed by the most incredible new spaces. Two fantastic galleries, there's a new shop, there's a cafe, there's also a marvellous new education room, and actually there's going to be small study rooms like we're sitting in at the moment, sort of archive research spaces. So it's really something for everyone.
The gallery space seems to be greatly extended, lots of imaginative use of the space that was there before, but I think the great thing about, from what I saw visually from the new Kettle's Yard, is it's still in keeping, although it's all modern, with the rest of Jim Eade's house and that Jim Eade feeling to the whole place.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a very tight site, a very difficult site, and it's a very historically important site, and the architect, Jamie Fobert, has been, I think, brilliant at sort of understanding, you know, its spatial volumes and actually creating new space out of what seems to be nothing. I mean, there was one little extra building. They bought the adjoining building, which is a narrow sort of, you know, three-storey building. But out of it, they've created these incredible volumes inside.
And Jamie Fogart obviously had a big job here. Are there some particular architectural features that make it special? Because the house is a very special thing. It's a treasure of Cambridge, isn't it? And it has so many different levels to walk around and so many artworks. What did he put in that was particularly interesting? Because every architect likes to leave his imprint on something, doesn't he?
Absolutely. Interesting you talk about levels. I think one of the sort of untold things about Kettle's Yard is that Jim Eade and architects after him actually liked all these different levels. Apparently there are 22 sets of stairs going up and down, so you're always moving, you're always coming at things a new angle. And Jamie's, I think, created that rather some mysterious voids, corners, steps. It's a very exciting new building to be in.
Now, in the basement, you've got the educational wing, which is basically you couldn't go in any other direction than down, could you, really? And you've gone down, you've now got that bigger space. Is that going to be somewhere that's going to be really important for children now? Because in the past, they ran things like MAD and all these drawing festivals and things like that, and I can see the drawings outside. That's going to be a place that's going to attract a lot of children, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, again, you know, the room before, the education room, was a small room, no windows, and they had real sort of capacity problems because, you know, classes are quite big. So they had to dig down. And I think so many education spaces and galleries, you know, all around England, they tend to be in the basement, you know, no windows. And this is the most brilliant, I know, intervention, that it's actually got natural light, sort of it's half street level, wonderful spaces. And there's going to be workshops for, you know, teenagers, children, adults, all abilities, accessible to all age. It's extraordinary.
Has the the refurbishment of Kettle's Yard basically broken the bank for the time being? That's another thing I wanted to ask.
I just think it has. It's been a huge capital project. I mean, I think it's on time, on budget. But yes, is this a sort of once in 50 year regeneration project as well as
I gather at on display are going to be some important artworks for the reopening of Kettle's Yard. Can you tell me a bit about those? Because we've got Jeremy Deller's paintings called Nelia Parker and also Richard Long.
I mean, it is a real licorice, all sorts of art, and there's a lot of sort of the 20th century classicals. There's Naam Garbo and Ben Nicholson, and then some of the artists you've just been sort of cutting edge. And then I have to admit, a lot of people who I don't know about. And I think really exciting. Art's got to keep reinventing itself. It's got to be new. It's going to be quite challenging. Political, activist, international art. And I think there's some fantastic surprises to be seen in the churchyard and outside, as well as installations inside.
What's going to happen with all of the links with other arts organisations now? Is that going to change at all? Because Andrew Nome was very enthusiastic about that when you first came.
I think it can only grow. I mean, more consolidation, more collaboration. I mean, Cambridge, there's a lot of colleges which have, you know, beautiful, quiet galleries and spaces. I'm thinking of the Hayong and obviously the Fitzwilliam people know, but actually even the Arcananth museums all have quiet modern collections tucked away. And then other communities around Cambridge, I mean, there's a big project, Arbury Open House, Eddington has got work. So, yeah, it's going to really make its mark over the whole of Cambridge.
So when do the doors actually open to the public again? When can they actually come into the building?
The big open day, cutting the ribbon, is Saturday the 10th of February. And I think it's going to be sort of open house and, you know, pandemonium, but very, very jolly, jolly party. And then there are a few pre-openings, which the Friends have got, and that's what I've been involved with the week before. So we'll be testing the furniture and the wall space.
Well, it's a tremendously exciting refurbishment. Penny Heath, thank you very much indeed for spending some time to talk to Arts Roundup.
It's a pleasure, Simon, as always.
Outside the building is a row of lights emphasising the message "Same for Everyone," and they asked me to remind the world that entry is completely free. The exhibition kicks off next week, and needless to say, it's a must if you like art in Cambridge. If you've ever enjoyed the art of sending up political buffoonery in the newspapers and magazines, you'll have come across the cartoons, magazine covers and caricatures of Andy Davey that aren't afraid of some humorous mischief and brevity. Andy, an editorial cartoonist, took the chair at Cambridge 105 to explore the life of cartoonists in today's Britain, which seems to be rather like sitting on a melting iceberg. It's a world that's getting smaller and somewhat colder for the trusty scribe in the digital age. Your work has been used by lots of top publications, obviously the Guardian, The Independent, The Sun, The Scotsman, Private Eye, Punch, The Spectator, The New Statesman and Prospect. And
that Times as well.
Yeah, The Times as well. Yeah. And that's just among others, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you say among others, but actually the field has shrunk considerably over the last few years, or last decade or so. The field available to cartoonists to get published.
So would you say that it's a dying art at the moment?
Well, this is one of the questions that, when cartoonists gaggle together to sob in their beer, they ask this question regularly, and we all think, of course, that the cartoons are great, you know, and we can't understand why there's a perception around that cartoons are dying. And I mean, of course, my opening remark was really underlying what you just said, which is that it's a dying art because there aren't so many openings in publications available. There aren't so many publications, for one thing. So you could draw that conclusion. But even when you speak to younger people, like journalists and stuff, they do appreciate the power of political cartoons. And also, especially if you speak to people in other countries whose regimes are a little more severe, you know, or even a lot more severe, you begin to see very quickly that the political cartoons are very important.
There's been a lot of bashing of the moral media, and obviously black humour and satire is one thing that people are less tolerant of now. Has there been a kind of retreat amongst the people who generally sort of mix things up a bit with cartoons and fun and black humour?
That is, to us, of course, that's anathema. You know, the very idea that a world without satire just seems like a world without flowers, you know.
Yeah.
It just seems like and of course it's a very unhealthy world. I mean, the same conditions that allow satire or encourage satire are the same conditions that encourage or promote a healthy society. So I think they're very important. But is it changing? I'm really not sure about whether it's changing or not. It may be a cyclical thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, you know, being a cartoonist, you can offend people. And I was reading on your website, you've wrote a considerable blog about Charlie Hebdo.
Oh, yeah.
And could it even be possibly, at times, slightly dangerous to be a cartoonist?
Well, it's obviously dangerous in Denmark and France. You know, I mean, what happened there was extremely shocking. But I guess for instances like that, which are very very isolated and very rare, you can't really change your behaviour based... Well, I mean, you can be more aware, but you can't really live your life cowed like that, because that's exactly what a terrorist would want you to do, to change your life.
How did you become a political cartoonist? Because you started off as a research chemist originally.
Yeah, well, that's an obvious route, of course, isn't it?
Obvious route, yes.
Yeah.
So did you go to art school?
No.
No, you didn't.
No.
So
I'd have been an even worse scientist if I'd gone to art school. No, I went through... I was kind of shuffled into science as a kid, and I quite enjoyed it. And of course, it was encouraged by teachers because it was seen as a very secure kind of career. And I enjoyed it, you know. But I wasn't... I remember, I guess my heart wasn't really, really in it. And I'd always harboured a dream, actually, as a kid, to be a cartoonist. And I kind of shuffled it away in the back of my mind, and then it re-emerged in later years.
OK, now, you've done, obviously, some great caricatures, you've done some cartoon strips, you've done magazine covers and things like that. Why do things like world news scenarios particularly attract your attention, and what do you get out of it when you attack them or approach those as subjects?
I suppose, you know, I guess the internal reward is some kind of, you know, kind of satisfaction of moral indignation, you know. you can be the sole dweller of the moral high ground if you publish a political cartoon, if you're lucky and your editor doesn't tell you can't do it, which is another problem. But I suppose what I enjoy about it is the fact that it allows an outlet for one's political anger or anger at the situation in the world, you know. And it's a nice way to express it without going on the streets and, you know, and beating people up. I mean, it's a kind of relatively benign form of expression.
Now, I was looking at your E-Sharp magazine covers, which, I mean, your drawings are very creative, but they're also slightly akin to, well, I think they're akin to spitting images in terms of the way that they portray people. You're quite cruel with your subject.
I think I'm quite kind, but I'm not very extreme. You know, compare it to someone like Gerald Scarfe's work, and it's very, very mild.
world.
The eSharp was a good example because it was one of the rare examples where European level politicians were depicted. The actual EU level politicians, and it's very rare that they actually get depicted anywhere. So they were absolutely overjoyed to be depicted at all, because of course the cover of a magazine like that, which was distributed in Brussels, was something to be coveted. You know, them appearing on anything public was a good thing to them. So they didn't care really how they were looked.
And working, obviously you've had cartoons in Private Eye in the past. Yeah. What's it like to work with Private Eye, obviously as a key group of satirists in Britain?
The thing about Private Eye is, I do know a few of them, but you don't work with them, because there are two different worlds in published cartoons. There's the world of the editorial cartoon, largely those people are employed by the papers, or they have a regular slot. But with something like Private Eye or the weeklies, the secondary publications like New Statesman and Spectator and what have you, those are the publications where you submit your work speculatively and you stand or fall every issue on your latest work. So you may get none published, you may get one published.
Hard to make ends meet if you're a cartoonist?
Yeah, increasingly so. I mean, it's okay if you have a regular job at a newspaper, but there are perhaps half a dozen in the country that are worth having, or 10 maybe. It's a ridiculously small field, and the rest aren't having a good time of it, really. Not unlike other people in the media. I mean, we're no special case. In a sense, we're very much like journalists or photographers or editors, sub-editors. You know, everyone has suffered through this digital revolution at that level, anyway.
I mean, I think that if cartoons through the digital revolution and the internet end up being kind of edged out, we'll lose those wonderful moments. I mean, looking at that cartoon in Private Eye, when Michael Gove was involved in some political backbiting and he fired one of his colleagues, and you had this marvellous cartoon where you had his Michael Gove's head next to the person involved, and suddenly he turned into a fish and gulped the whole head of the person next to him.
Well, you can tell.
And that was just like a marvellous piece of cartoonery. It was just,
well, you can tell so much of a story in cartoon form, and you can get away with more because you're not using words. It's not libelous in that sense. So you can do much more because of the medium. But also, the drawn medium is a powerful thing, you know, and people respond to the drawn image in a stronger way than they do to words. You tend to drift off when you're reading, you know, but you see a cartoon on top of a sort of pile of words,
you get a lot of reaction to the work you do, because I always find that they have a tremendous impact on me, cartoons, especially the really funny ones. They just they just have me rolling around laughing.
Yeah, laugh at that
and obviously, someone like Donald Trump must be an absolute gift to the world of cartoon, rather like Thatcher was. Yeah. But these kind of unreal, larger-than-life figures who have amazing amounts of power. I mean, what do you think of Donald Trump, especially of late? How would you approach him with your black humour, as it were?
In a sense, he's almost too much of a caricature to get a laugh from, because you don't need any kind of editorial comment on Donald Trump. It just speaks for itself. You know, I saw a photograph the other day of him trying to form, you know, the way we cross hands at like New Year's Eve and sing Auld Lang Syne. You know, there was a bunch of world leaders on one of these G20 meetings, and they were all sort of doing this, and there's Trump in the middle, and he's trying to work out how to connect hands in the right way with his partners, and it's obviously completely floored him. And, you know, you can't satirise that. That's a perfect moment without any attempt at editorial comment. I mean, you can satirise Trump, but it almost seems like kind of, you know, gilding a lily, really.
I've been reading Luke Harding's Collusion, which is basically a chapter and verse argument to say that he's in it up to his neck with the Russians or whatever it is. And what I noticed also, on a similar point, was that a lot of the people who had been at these meetings said that his attempts to sort of bear hug people had all gone disastrously wrong. And so his body language doesn't actually work in the political sphere. And I thought this was sort of quite hilarious. And also, obviously, the whole idea that that some people have accused him of having dementia, it also turns him into something of a comical figure in many ways.
Well, I mean, he's a tragic comic figure, isn't he? You know, absolutely he's comical. I mean, in a sense, I guess we never thought, well, it's gone incrementally, hasn't it? We thought, oh, Reagan was a laugh, and then George Bush came along. And now, George Bush looks like a statesman next to Trump. But I wasn't aware of that, the thing about him trying to hug people. I mean, I guess he would get it wrong, of course. What does he do, crush them or something? Does he just go too far?
He crushes them or he treats them clumsily, or it just all sort of seems to backfire on him. So, that's what it says in this book.
Anyway. Well, I can't imagine he's a man of great emotional intelligence, so he wouldn't be able to sort of assess a situation with his social radar. He would just go in like a bulldozer, wouldn't he?
Now, what are you working on at the moment? What's attracted your eye?
Today, actually, Trump. It was, two things. It was the terrible, dreadful comment he made about these African countries, you know, and Haiti and such like. But that doesn't seem quite... I mean, that's terrible in its sense. But what attracted me more, I think, and what probably attracts me for a cartoon tomorrow is the London Embassy thing, you know, where he seems to have taken a strop because he thinks we might be angry at him or not sufficiently pleased with him.
Mm-hmm. So you do a pretty good Trump. I've seen a Trump on your website. And also a very good IDS and a very good Prince Charles as well.
Oh, they're old ones, aren't they? IDS was a gift, really, because he looked like a billiard ball with teeth, you know. And a strange kind of Dickensian figure. Charles is just a gift, isn't he? You know, the FA Cup, given physical form. But caricature, I mean, I kind of enjoy caricature, but only, I suppose, I enjoy it as a sort of adjunct, because it's one skill of cartooning. You know, you need to draw a caricature within a political cartoon. I used to do a lot of caricatures. I used to do, you know, even on-the-spot drawing of caricatures at events and things, but, you know, I did thousands of them, and in the end, it just drives you mad, you know.
Now, obviously, you feel strongly enough to be a political cartoonist. Do you think that cartoonery can actually ever really have much power in terms of tackling injustices in society? Is that something you think it can ever really do?
Well, in this country, probably not, because we're just too sort of sophisticated or whatever, we're too smart, too smarty pants. But in other countries, yes, it does, and it really does have an effect. I've spoken recently to a few cartoonists actually who are facing prison in their respective countries because of the comments they made in their cartoons, and they really do have an effect, to the extent, like in the Arab Spring, in various countries where there were demonstrations in the streets, the demonstrators had appropriated certain strong image cartoons and put them on posters, and even made prints, or not prints, painted like Banksy images on walls using stencils. So they'd taken the liberty taken the effort to make a stencil of the cartoon and painted them on walls in strategic places. And people understood these images, you know, wordless images. They're the most powerful kind of cartoons, I guess. So, you know, if they're used in those situations, then I think that's a wonderful demonstration that they are quite a powerful thing. My thought about how cartoons will develop over the next few years is, if the last few years are anything to go by, is that they will probably be more radical, but they'll probably be unpaid in a sort of, and drawn by, for want of a better word, amateurs. You know, people they are amateurs, they're not paid, but people who aren't beholden, essentially, to a proprietor of a newspaper or someone who's going to edit their work. They'll want their work unmediated. And the only real way to do that is to work for yourself and not get paid for it. So I think, and it's the way that the media seems to be moving, you know, a more atomized kind of bedsit kind of journalism, you know, not the mainstream media, which is suffered slings and arrows in recent years. But I guess the real potent stuff is going to come from outside of that.
Great stuff. Andy, thank you very much indeed for coming in and talking to me.
Thank you, Simon.
I can hear a man in the next room having a glass of wine and just realising that he's on the cover of the new magazine on the table. Sorry about that, old boy. You just caught his damnable eye that time. Like me, you may not have been lucky enough to get a ticket to the sellout choir concert in the dark in the Round Church in January with We Are Sound, but there will be other chances later in the year. In the Dark took full advantage of the 12th century's slightly spooky architecture with little lighting, altering our normal take on choir music by exploiting the dark to make its source less visible, and to explore the visual aspects of the church interior in terms of shadows and altered states. In fact, the Green Knight might just have been waiting in the wings. Choir founder Andrea Cockerton came in to talk on being a singer in Cambridge and brought in some freshly recorded sound. With me here is Andrea Cockerton, who is a woman of many parts, as far as I gather from the little I've heard from you so far. I gather that you're a singer with the Cambridge Choir We Are Sound.
Yep, so it's a big musical project that I set up in 2010, and we currently number around 120 singers and anything up to about 20 instrumentalists, and we do some both big and very small gigs in the city.
Now, you've been doing a gig just recently, which I gather completely sold out.
The demand's been fantastic. Fantastic.
Was it called Music from the Dark?
It's just called In the Dark.
In the Dark, yeah. So what was the basic concept behind doing that?
Well, I think our lives are really busy. We're inundated with information and sounds and just senses all the time. And what I was trying to do was to think about how do people listen when all they're doing is using their sense of hearing. And so we set up a concept where we found a beautiful old venue, the Round Church in Cambridge. And the model is that we put the audience into the middle of that round space and in the dark, and there's a little bit of ambient light for those people that get a bit claustrophobic, but we also give all the audience sleep masks so they can go total immersion. And it's really to see how do people hear when they're not using their other senses, and also how do they respond when they're not being observed by other people. And the response has been phenomenal. It's been called countercultural. People have come out weeping. It's a real experience.
That sounds really interesting because, I mean, having a look at the video, which you showed me a little bit earlier, you have the Round Church, which is this wonderful, I think originally a 12th or 13th century Norman church.
Yeah.
And it has these wonderful round areas with naves. It has the two parts of the church and then an altar and lovely windows and everything else. But in the dark, when it's partially lit and what have you, it looks much more mysterious and a much better setting for music.
It feels very mysterious. You can feel as people were walking in, and actually we found that quite a lot of people, both from the group performing and from the people coming as ticket holders, had lived in Cambridge for donkey's years and had never been inside the building. So for them it's a real, you know, wow, this, we've got this here, and what a beautiful space it is.
I suppose having it as a city centre occasion as well, it makes it very convenient for everybody to go to. Yeah. Now that was just the first of several of those, wasn't it?
Yeah, originally we set one date and we're doing short gigs, short In the Dark sound experiences, because I think probably too long in the dark might be a little bit too much for the audience. So they're 40 minutes. It's maximum, and we set up 4 gigs on that first day, and they sold out within 2 days, I think. So we set up another date for 5 shows, and they sold out in 10 hours. And then we've set up 2 more, one for January, one for February. They sold out in 8 hours. The response has been just off the charts, really. And I think it's because it's something different, and because there is something wonderful about giving yourself over to that and being totally there for that 30, 40 minutes.
Getting involved in choirs, lots of people in Cambridge, I mean, these days are joining choirs because they're getting a lot out of it.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, why people join and also how difficult is it to actually learn to sing competently?
There are a whole range of choirs in the city, ranging from community choirs where you have to have no experience at all and where you're probably singing simple tunes through to the choirs at the university colleges, the chapel choirs, where it's a really high standard and you must be able to read music. So I think each choir is going to have its own entry point, if you like. We sit in the middle, so we welcome both people that can read music and can't read music. And I think also in terms of experience of people coming to us, some people have never done anything like this before. So they're learning to use their voice at the same time. And watching and observing the singers that I've got in the group, I can see how a number of them came and they were initially really nervous. And their voice was not perhaps as in, they weren't in control of it yet. And I've seen how they've progressed and it's now much more in their hands and they can use it and put it into places that perhaps they hadn't thought that they would be able to do. So it's brilliant to see people progress. I think Cambridge is a fantastic place to sing. We've got great buildings, there's a lot of musical history, a lot of great talents, and a lot of variety.
And presumably it's great for meeting new people as well.
It's brilliant. Yeah. I personally think that people come for a number of reasons. They want to get out of their normal life, want to meet some people, have some fun, want to be challenged. And also that sense, I think something we work hard in our group is that we purposely do gigs rather than stuffy concerts. And there's quite a lot of adrenaline. So that is quite addictive. I think that buzz when you get when you've just pulled off a gig with crazy sound and production issues, and it's all finally come together at the last point and worked, and then a post show party. So that's for my singers. That's I think all part of it.
I mean, I had a recent experience when I went down to Jesus Lock to meet some friends, and three separate choirs turned up to sing just by the Spade and Beckett pub to the public and to the people passing.
Oh,
On the punts, and it was absolutely wonderful.
They were singing on the punts.
They were singing on the bank to people passing by, and people just enjoying the sun and what have you. And we had one choir from Russia, we had two other choirs from Cambridge, and it was a really pleasant experience just having this music, just this beautiful music played out in a public space in Cambridge.
Yeah, and of course you do it the other way around. So I was at college here, and I was a choral scholar at Trinity, and they still do, I think. We sang then on the punts with the audiences on the bank, so the other way around. And it was always a lovely, lovely experience.
Another experience which I found was going into Trinity Chapel when the music scholars were practising.
Yeah.
It was also an incredibly rewarding experience because you had those fantastic acoustics.
Absolutely.
And you had them playing this music to a wonderfully high standard.
Yeah.
And getting involved in that seems to me tremendously exciting. Now, what about the people? What are they like at We Are Sound? Tell me a bit about the program.
A whole bunch of mavericks. There is no one type of person that comes to us, so it's all ages, probably from about 25 to about 70. We've got a very strong chunk of men, so there's about 35 men in our group, which is quite rare. We're really pleased with that. We've got teachers, we've got academics, we've got people that are unemployed, we've got people that work in the music industry, people that have been on the West End, people that have sung in bands, and on it goes. It's just a really interesting collective of people.
Now, have there been any weird and wonderful experiences that people have had? Just think stories that have cropped up as a result of taking part in this activity.
Well, I know that quite a few bands have sprung out of it.
Yeah.
So quite a few people have paired together and set up either small bands or small a cappella singing groups. So that kind of stuff comes out just really naturally. There's quite a strong social element. So I believe all the men went for a Christmas curry before Christmas, and all the women, which is about 85 of us, are going for a New Year curry quite soon. So stuff like that comes out of it. And then we get asked to do quite quirky events, musical and otherwise. It's always there.
Okay, so we're now going to listen to a piece of music from We Are Sound, just to get some of the flavour from... Is it called Music in the Dark?
Or? So Just in the Dark, and this is one of the... It's a very quiet, beautiful piece of music that gives a sense of the In the Dark gig.
Thank you.
It's a cover, I should say, of a track by Jake Halsby called Howl.
First of all, Andrea, can you tell me a little bit about yourself? Are you a mum? What do you do?
Oh, I would love to be a mum, but sadly I'm not. I run in my day job, if you like. My full-time work is something called We Are Sound, and that's a big musical collective in Cambridge of about 120 singers and about 20 instrumentalists. I do a little bit of something else. So I've worked in the business community for about 15 years now. I work with entrepreneurs pitching for funding, so I'm a pitch coach, and I still do that, and I really enjoy it, I have to confess.
Now, as far as I gather, you are actually an organiser of a brand new Cambridge festival, which is possibly going to be opening in the city this summer, which is going to be a really big event. Now, tell me about it.
So it's called House of Cambridge, and the strapline, if you like, is a feast of festivals. So for many, many years, I've been wanting to bring a tent to Parker's Peace, actually to stage We Are Sound, but I've realised that for a one-off gig, that's just prohibitively expensive, and so I kind of parked the idea. And then talking with a gentleman called Paul Smith from Cam Creative in the middle of last year, he mentioned that there used to be a Cambridge Arts Festival in the 80s, and this was a kind of penny drop moment, because I thought, well, actually I know quite a few of the festival founders now that have got the Literary Festival and Jazz Festival. Why don't we try and pull them all together for 1 week? That we don't do that. Edinburgh does it brilliantly, but in Cambridge we're doing our brilliant things independently. So that's the model, is to try and persuade the existing festivals in Cambridge and also some creative curators in the city to put some content for 1 week only all together in a new festival, the House of Cambridge.
So the whole idea originated from you, it's your idea, basically.
Well, it was from a conversation with Paul, and he really sparked it, and then but the Feast of Festivals absolutely was I know these guys, let's approach them, let's try and do it.
Now, actually, I mean, from what I've read, that from the limited amount of publicity that's come out of it so far, is that actually things to do with this festival are already starting to take place, with taster performances and things like that. Now, who's doing what and where?
We're planning lots of different things, so there will be announced soon some Sunday night music sessions where we're going to try and promote some of local bands in Cambridge. We are going to be holding some big warm-up events in the lead up to the festival, one of which will be at the Brewboard Brewery out in Harston. They're one of our great supporters, and we love Nick and the rest of the team at Brewboard. We've got Thirsty on board, and we're looking to do some events in their summer beer garden. And so on it goes. There's all these ad hoc events that we're planning right now, so I can't say right on the 2nd of February at 6 p.m. we've got this coming yet, but it's not far away.
You're going to be inviting basically some local artists to perform, but there's also talk of a competition involved. Is that right, or am I getting that wrong?
There is so much going on, so we're looking at doing a Cambridge Cake Off, which will be a competition. So food is art, that'll be part of it. We've already had a photography competition where lots of people submitted photos of the city to take part, and we will be looking at running probably a busking competition as well, which may end up in the winner performing in one of the bigger performing spaces.
Now, it links up all of these stakeholders like Thirsty and Brewhouse and all these other people, but it kind of ties in with all of the other festivals, doesn't it? So basically, I mean, this is going to make the Cambridge experience in the summer even more interesting than it already is, basically, by adding another layer to it all.
That's exactly the aim. It's to kind of big up what we've got and also to welcome to the city what we haven't yet got. So we're looking at Edinburgh, and we're looking at Brighton and some of the content they've got there, and we will try and invite some of those performers and artists to the city. And in terms of, we haven't yet spoken to all of the festivals. We're running as fast as we can. We've got more to do, but we've got the film festival on board, the jazz festival, the comedy festival, the festival of ideas, the science festival, the Cambridge Cocktail Weekend, and the Achbar Music Festival.
And the Fringe
the
Festival.
The Junction. And we're doing a Fringe, yeah.
Okay, now can you take me through a few of the key artists who are going to be performing? What are they like, and what's it like working with them?
Well, that is actually a tricky question, because we can't confirm these artists, although we've got some absolutely golden ones that we're trying to book, until we've got the money to do so. So right now, as we sit today, we are in the middle of funding for the festival. If you think, putting a 800 capacity antique tent onto 4,000 square metres of Parker's Peace, that takes a lot of toilets, a lot of fencing, a lot of stewarding, a lot of security. We're trying to raise a rather large amount of money. And when we get that money, we can then book artists. But I can tell you the kind of things we're after are, we're looking at Benjamin Clementine, who we would love to bring to the city. We are looking at David O'Doherty, I think, in comedy, and also another comedian that I can't remember right now. we local amazing talent like Neon Moon is definitely going to are definitely going to be involved. We will be we're looking at a group called the Ayub Sisters as well. So it's this is our actually conundrum right now. We've got to get our funding sorted to book those names so that we can guarantee to pay them. And as soon as we've got that, we are on a roll.
So what kind of people should consider funding you and why?
That's a really good question. We're talking to local businesses. I think we've approached nigh on about 150 so far. It is a golden sponsorship opportunity, mainly because the combined mailing lists of all the festival partners is massive. And there's obviously a visitor tourism angle to this too. So any local businesses wanting to get some profile and that love the arts and would like to have some tickets to come and see us, then we'd love to talk to local businesses. And any high net worth individuals lurking out there that support the arts, then we'd love to talk to them.
Now, this is going to be, it'll be a really big thing if it's a success, because then you're going to have your job cut out for you after that, aren't you? Because you'll have so much work to do.
That's true. And the important thing to say is not just me. So there's a team of about 8 of us working on this. We're all doing it in our spare time right now, flat out, as you can imagine. We've got Eddie Barkin, who's going to be the production manager, and he was the man behind the Folk Festival for 23 years. And we've got Vicky Fenton, who's dressing the site. And who else have we got? We've got Ellen Downs, who is behind Enchanted Cinema, who's one of our team working with young people, and so on and so forth. So there's a whole bunch of people. And yes, we have got our work cut out for us. The plan is long term. This isn't just a one-off event. It's 5, 10, 15 years.
Well, it sounds like an absolutely fabulous idea. And
Thanks,
I wish you all the best of success with it. Andrea Cockerton, thank you very much indeed for talking to us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, when it comes to seriously messing about with light artistically, there's no one quite so good at organising it to go really large as Alexandra Caggiano, director of the Illuminate Cambridge Festival, and she's about to throw the high-energy switches projecting light artworks onto the city's most impressive buildings once again this month. This time, with ongoing sponsorship from Panasonic and the help of digital marketing consultant Sukio, she's bringing a big-name artist to join the local fold from abroad, and has a lineup of city centre light installations using light technology developed in Cambridge. The Illuminate Festival about to kick off in Cambridge. It's in its 6th year under your directorship. You must be really delighted with what's happened with it so far from its initial idea.
I am indeed, Simon. The idea has grown organically and people have really taken up to it. It's become really popular and one of the most loved events that we have in Cambridge.
Now, how did it come about? Because you had a core concept for it, didn't you, in the first place? How did it come about, the whole idea?
Well, the whole idea was actually happened because I noticed a gap, if you want, something that wasn't there. And I've taken advantage of it in bringing a new type of art form into Cambridge, which did not exist before. So the realization that the city, with all its beautiful architecture and magnificent buildings, was absolutely plunged into darkness, you know, as soon as the sun goes down, and the opportunity that exists to do something truly imaginative and innovative on this space is really was too big and too exciting not to think. So this year we really upped our game in terms of the artistic value of the festival. We invited some really big names of the in this particular branch of the arts. So in particular, we're delighted to announce that Patrice Warner will be joining us from France, from Lyon. He's one of the most widely recognized light projection artists in the world. He's worked on, created this specific and unique technique for projecting with color, which happened to be the theme of the 2018 festival as well. And he's worked all over the world in illuminating beautiful architecture. So it was a natural choice to invite him over for the 2018 festival.
What are the key installations? What are people going to find?
People are going to find installations on Senate House and Gombil and Caius College, onto King's College Chapel. So we kept the installation into a really easy to find route in the city centre so that the audience experience is maximised. And we have put on light on some of the most iconic buildings, as well as obviously worked with some of our long-term partners, such as the Guildhall and the City Council, of course.
Now you're marrying light technology and things like energy-saving glass and other things like that into these artworks. What are the products and developments of the light high technology firms who are showcasing this time around?
So we're super proud because, as I always said right from the beginning, Illuminate Cambridge is really the intersection of arts and technology coming together on this beautiful platform that is our city. So we're working with high technology equipment and products from the likes of Panasonic. We have lighting fixtures from Philips and a series of other incredibly big brands with the newest technology. And we work with also with experimental and research groups at the university. So we've got product and equipment that are more in a sort of initial experimental phase as well.
We're dealing in hard times at the moment, and lots of art projects are having trouble getting hold of funding. What's happened in terms of sponsorship and funding? You've got Panasonic again this year, haven't you?
We're super excited about Panasonic reconfirming their sponsorship to Illuminate Cambridge, of course. But as you said, it has been harder. The point is really to continue to innovate and find new ways to attract sponsors, to attract partners, supporters, and obviously paying audiences as well.
As a partner, you're involved as a stakeholder in this project. Can you tell me a little bit about what you do?
Well, I run a digital marketing agency called Sukio, and so for us to partner with the festival, because what we do is very visual and it's rooted in technology, then it's the perfect kind of collaboration, really. And I first saw Ali talking about it at Cam Creative, I don't know how many years ago, 5 years ago or something, yeah. When it was the germ of an idea. And to watch from the sidelines and see the festival grow and develop to what it is today is just really impressive. So we're just really proud to be involved.
Well, who you're inviting in for the launch, because the launch is coming up quite soon, isn't it?
Well, everyone is invited to the launch. The launch, the inaugural opening ceremony in Market Square is free and open for everyone to join. So we really hope that everyone will make the most of it. It starts around 7 o'clock in Market Square, and at 7:30 the mayor will say a few words and the lights will go on.
So what's the message to people this year? Because you do reshuffle the cards each time round, and you have different companies, different messages. So what's going out at the different locations?
Well, this year we're very much concentrated, as I said, on the theme of colour and celebrating some key important facts. Like, for example, 2018 is 345th anniversary of the Newtonian papers, which is an extremely exciting thing for Cambridge. Very, very specific, very, very scientific. But if you think about the importance of those papers in terms of researching light and everything that meant, it's a colour, etc., etc. So it's a beautiful opportunity and occasion to celebrate all of those scientific discoveries and the innovation that comes out of this very city on a regular basis.
Tell me about Sukio's role in it. Can you expand on that a little bit? Just let me know how it works.
Yeah, well, we've been a supporter of the festival for, this is our third year now, so we started off just by placing an ad in the programme, and then last year we sponsored the whale exhibition along with the zoology museum. So it's this fabulous whale that was projected onto the side of the wall, and so yeah, we supported that, and because it was in partnership with the zoology museum, they kindly spoke about us a lot on social media. They made some awful whale puns, which we joined in with as well. So because what we do is a lot to do with words, copyright and that kind of thing, then we quite enjoy that kind of thing. We did get very interested in the way that the artist designed this whale in itself, so how she did all the illustrations and how that married up with the projection, because it's not like, you know, you don't just get a projection and just point it at a wall and then walk away. And that particularly interests me because so much of what we do, it's where, you know, the visuals, the arts, the creativity meets the technical side, which is what I find so interesting. And in fact, the talk that we're sponsoring, the Cambridge Colour Talk, will have both of those perspectives, so a very scientific perspective and then the creativity as well, which is personally what I find quite interesting.
Where will the Cambridge Colour Talk take place?
Well, I'm glad you asked. It's at the Cambridge Union on the Saturday, so the launch of the festival is the Friday, and then this is the Saturday.
And that brings us to the end of the programme, and I hope you've enjoyed listening to Arts Roundup on Cambridge 105, and will get in touch with us if you have a creative story to tell.